Picture this. You're holding your phone, trying to, quickly look something up. You tap a link, the page starts loading, and you see the exact button you need.
Right. We have all been there.
Yeah, exactly. So you move your thumb to click it, but right at that very millisecond, bam, the entire page violently shifts downward.
Oh, I hate that.
Right. A giant banner ad loads exactly where your thumb is landing, and suddenly you're being redirected to some, I don't know, spammy website selling novelty socks or something. We have all felt that specific, highly potent type of internet rage.
It is a completely universal digital frustration. I mean, it's infuriating.
Yeah.
But today we are doing a deep dive into Core Web Vitals, or CWV.
Which is Google's official scorecard for that exact poor user experience, really.
Exactly. It's their codified way of measuring it. Our mission today is to basically take you on a comprehensive learning journey through our sources, unpacking all the technical SEO performance fundamentals.
So we can understand precisely how to measure, diagnose, and, fundamentally fix a slow or unstable website.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Setting the stage here. Though these Core Web Vitals, they aren't just a suggestion box from Google. They align directly with what their core ranking systems are actually looking to reward.
Which is a huge deal for anyone running a site.
Definitely. But there is a massive catch that honestly continues to blindside developers. It's an all or nothing test. A page must get a good rating in all three of these metrics to get any ranking benefit whatsoever.
Yep. Partial credit is not a thing here. Passing 2 out of 3 gets you absolutely nowhere.
Which means before we can fix a site, we really have to understand the specific criteria of the test, right?
We do. Google has set 3 primary 2026 Core Web Vitals. To visualize how these actually work together, think of a website loading like a live concert.
Oh, I like that. A live concert. Okay.
So the first metric is largest contentful paint, or LCP. In our concert analogy, LCP is how fast the main act actually takes the stage.
Gotcha. So, like the headliner.
Right. Technically speaking, it's the time it takes the largest visible element in the viewport, so like a massive hero image or the primary text block, to fully render on the screen.
And the threshold for that is incredibly tight. I mean, reading the sources, to be in the good band, your LCP must be less than or equal to 2.5 seconds.
Exactly, 2.5 seconds. Anything more, and you're dropping into needs improvement or just outright failing. Then comes the second metric, cumulative layout shift, or CLS.
Okay, so how does CLS fit into the concert?
Well, going back to the concert, this is asking, does the stage collapse while you're watching? Are the speakers randomly shifting across the floorboards?
Oh, man.
Yeah, it measures visual stability and unexpected shifting. Google actually calculates this using a very specific formula. It's the impact fraction multiplied by the distance fraction.
Okay, let's unpack this math because it shows just how stripped this whole system is.
It really does.
The impact fraction is how much of the viewport the shifting element takes up, and the distance fraction is how far it actually moved. So if a text block takes up, say, 50% of your phone screen, an impact fraction of 0.5, and a late loading image shoves it down by 20% of the screen, a distance fraction of 0.2, Google multiplies 0.5 by 0.2.
Right, which gives you a CLS score of 0.1.
At 0.1 is the maximum allowable limit to stay in the good category.
Exactly. That single tiny shift just maxed out your entire layout shift budget for the entire lifespan of that page.
Wow, that is brutal.
It is. Which brings us to the third metric, interaction to next paint, or IMP. In our concert scenario, this is basically how fast the band responds when the crowd yells out a request.
So responsiveness, like if you click a drop-down menu, add an item to a cart, or tap a date picker, how fast does the page actually react and paint the next frame?
Yes. And the good threshold here is less than or equal to 200 milliseconds.
Just 200 milliseconds. That's a blink.
Literally a blink. But what's fascinating here is that the real kicker for all three of these metrics is that they are measured strictly at the 75th percentile of your users,
Yeah.
segmented across both desktop and mobile.
75th percentile? Meaning what exactly?
Meaning if 100 people visit your website on their phones, at least 75 of them must experience a load time of 2.5 seconds or faster, an INP under 200 milliseconds, and a CLS under 0.1.
Oh, wow. So you can't just rely on users with like gigabit fiber connections to artificially inflate your average.
No, not at all. Averages are useless here. Looking at INP specifically, though, this is a relatively recent massive shift in how we actually measure responsiveness.
Right, because up until March of 2024, the industry standard was first input delay, or FID, right?
Exactly. The sources detail a six-month deprecation window where FID was completely wiped from Google Search Console and totally replaced by IMP.
Why the sudden swap? Didn't FID work fine?
Well, no. The rationale there comes down to a glaring architectural flaw in how FID was calculated. FID only measured the browser's queue delay before it began processing the very first interaction on a page.
Just the delay before the first click.
Yep. It completely ignored the actual processing time of the interaction itself. It ignored the presentation delay of painting the next frame. And most importantly, it ignored every single interaction after that first initial click.
I can see how that creates a massive blind spot. Especially with modern single-page applications, you know, SPAs built on frameworks like React.
Oh, absolutely. The blind spot was huge.
Because a user arrives, they click a menu button, and the browser registers the click immediately. So FID gives you a passing grade. But behind the scenes, a massive JavaScript bundle is high-grading the page, locking up the browser's main thread for half a second before the menu actually opens.
Precisely. And IMP was introduced to catch exactly that kind of lag. It observes every single interaction, every click, tap, keyboard input over the entire life cycle of the page.
So it's watching everything.
Yes. And then it reports the worst or near worst full latency interaction. It is a much truer measure of the friction a user experiences rather than just grading the browser's initial reflexes.
Okay, so armed with those three metrics, LCP, CLS, and INP, we run into the first major operational roadblock. Reading through the research, there's this dangerous measurement illusion that really plagues web development.
The lab versus field data issue.
Yeah. You can run your URL through Google's PageSpeed Insights, see the sea of green passing scores, and just assume your SEO is perfectly fine. But you might actually be failing core web vitals in the real world.
That confusion stems from the two completely different sets of data presented in those reports. You have lab data and you have field data.
And the most accurate way to separate them, I think, is to imagine testing a new sports car.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear it.
Lab data is like putting that car in a high-tech wind tunnel. It's a completely controlled, isolated simulation. You know all the variables. But field data is taking that exact same car and driving it in real-world traffic, over potholes, in a rainstorm, with a driver who is simultaneously eating a sandwich and, like, riding the brakes.
That is a perfect analogy. In the context of Google evaluating your site, lab data is generated right then and there by running a lighthouse simulation.
Which is pretty standard.
Right. It forces a specific throttled profile, typically simulating a mid-tier Moto G4 device, on a slow 4G connection. Because it is a sterile environment, it is highly reproducible.
So it's good for debugging. Like, if you rewrite a JavaScript function, you can run lab data instantly to see if your simulated INP drops.
Exactly. It's a diagnostic tool. But the reality is your actual users aren't sitting in a wind tunnel. That brings us to field data, which is sourced directly from CRUX, the Chrome User Experience Report.
And this isn't a simulation at all, right?
Not even a little. It is a public data set of real performance metrics collected anonymously at the operating system level from actual Google Chrome users.
Okay, so real people on real phones.
Real people. And CRUX aggregates a rolling 28-day window of this data. It captures real device diversity, fragmented cellular networks, and actual human behavior patterns.
So a developer sitting in a London office on a brand new M3 MacBook Pro compiling lab data might see a blazing fast 1.2 second LCP.
Oh, easily.
But if their primary customer base is commuting on a subway using three-year-old Android phones with a dozen apps running in the background, the field LCP might be like 4.5 seconds.
Exactly. And the sources are incredibly explicit about this point. Field data is the only thing that impacts your Google rankings.
Wait, really? The only thing?
The only thing. Lab data is strictly a local diagnostic tool. If your field data fails at the 75th percentile in the CRUX report, your site fails Core Web Vitals completely, regardless of what your local Lighthouse test says.
Wow. Which forces us to look really closely at the actual code deployed in the wild. Because when sites fail these field tests, it is rarely due to a lack of effort.
Oh, developers are trying very hard.
But it's almost always a case of developers or SEOs implementing accepted best practices in fundamentally flawed ways.
It is the classic problem of self-sabotage.
Right, and here's where it gets really interesting. The most glaring pitfall we see regarding the largest contentful pain is the misuse of lazy loading on hero images.
Oh, the lazy loading disaster.
Yes, the industry has spent a decade preaching the gospel of lazy loading, adding the, you know, loading lazy attribute. So the browser defers downloading an image until the user scrolls near it. It saves precious bandwidth.
But applying that attribute to the massive hero image at the very top of your page is one of the absolute fastest ways to destroy your LCP score.
Because it delays the main act from taking the stage.
Precisely. To understand why, you have to look at how a browser's rendering engine actually processes code. When a browser receives an HTML document, it sends out a preload scanner.
What does that do?
Well, this scanner rips through the raw code looking for heavy assets like images and fonts to start downloading immediately, even before the page layout is calculated.
Okay, that sounds efficient.
It is, but if the scanner hits a loading lazy attribute, it completely ignores the image. It assumes the image is buried way down at the bottom of the page.
Oh, I see. So it just skips the most important image.
Yep. It isn't until the browser finishes building the document object model, calculates the CSS object model, and actually maps out the visual viewport that it realizes, oh wait, the hero image is sitting right at the very top of the screen.
You've intentionally blinded the preload scanner to the most important visual element on the page. That's wild. So what's the fix?
The fix requires doing the exact opposite of the old best practice. For your LCP image, you explicitly use loading eager, and you append the attribute fetch priority high.
Eager and high priority.
Exactly. This acts as a massive flare, signaling the browser's network stack to drop everything and grab that specific asset immediately.
Of course, how the browser fetches the image is really only half the battle. If you're forcing it to eagerly fetch a massive, uncompressed JPEG, you're still going to fail LCP.
That is very true. File size still matters.
The sources heavily emphasize upgrading image formats, specifically utilizing Google's WebP format, which generally delivers like 25 to 35% smaller file sizes than JPEGs without losing visual fidelity.
Right. And we can push that even further with AVIF, an image format derived from the AV1 video codec, which offers superior compression to WebP.
But not all browsers support AVIF yet, do they?
That's where the implementation gets clever. It utilizes the HTML picture element for progressive enhancement. You list the AVIF file as the primary source, WebP as the secondary, and a standard JPEG as the final fallback.
So the browser just parses that stack and automatically downloads the lightest format its rendering engine supports.
Exactly. It's foolproof.
Okay, moving from LCP to interactivity, we hit the second major self-sabotage pitfall, render blocking scripts. Returning to our live concert analogy.
Let's hear it.
If LCP is the band taking the stage, render blocking scripts are like overly aggressive security guards standing on the loading ramp. They stop every single roadie, open every single guitar case, and read every serial number before letting anyone onto the stage.
Yes. A render blocking script is typically a JavaScript file located in the head of the HTML document.
Right.
When the browser's main thread is reading the HTML to build the page and hits a standard script tag, it literally has to halt parsing. It stops building the page, reaches out to a server, downloads the script, and executes it completely before it can read the next line of HTML.
Which is a huge bottleneck. If a marketing team has stacked the head tag with 3 tracking pixels, an A/B testing framework, and a bloated customer support chat widget, the browser is just paralyzed.
Completely paralyzed. The user's just staring at a blank white screen.
So to bypass these security guards, we have to leverage 2 specific HTML attributes, async and defer.
Yes, but the mechanics of how those 2 attributes interact with the DOM parser are entirely different. And honestly, mixing them up will break a website.
Okay, so break them down for us. What does async do?
The async attribute tells the browser to download the script in the background in parallel with parsing the HTML. But the exact millisecond the script finishes downloading, the browser halts HTML parsing and executes the script.
Oh, so it interrupts whenever it's ready. That makes async perfect for totally independent third-party tools, right? Like an analytics beacon.
Exactly. It doesn't rely on the page layout, and no other scripts rely on it. It just fires whenever it's ready.
Okay, so what about defer?
Defer, on the other hand, also downloads in parallel, but it comes with strict instructions to wait. It tells the browser not to execute the script until the entire HTML document is fully parsed and the DOM tree is built.
Ah, so it's polite. It waits its turn.
Very polite.
Yeah.
Furthermore, scripts marked with defer are executed in the exact order they appear in the document.
Which is crucial, right?
Absolutely. If you have a script that manipulates the page layout or relies on a library like jQuery being loaded first, it must be deferred, never async.
Okay, so resolving LCP in scripts naturally leads us to the third pitfall, the jumping page. This is the Core Web Vitals metric CLS, the layout shift we discussed with the misclicked ad at the top of the deep dive.
The rage-inducing ad click.
Exactly. We know what it feels like, but structurally, a layout shift almost always boils down to the browser's rendering engine not knowing how much physical space to save for an asset that is loading asynchronously.
Yes. The two biggest defenders draining a site's CLS budget are images without explicit dimensions and dynamically injected third-party ad slots.
So if an image tag lacks explicit width and height attributes in the HTML, the browser just assumes it takes up zero space.
Right. The surrounding text flows right up to the top of the container.
And then, a few hundred milliseconds later, the image finally finishes downloading. The browser calculates its intrinsic size, realizes it's an 800-pixel tall graphic, and violently shoves the entire DOM structure down to make room.
Exactly. The technical fix is rudimentary, but it is constantly overlooked. You must apply explicit width and height attributes directly to the HTML MMG tags.
Even if you are utilizing modern CSS to make the image fluid and responsive.
Even then, those raw HTML attributes provide the browser with the exact aspect ratio. The rendering engine uses that ratio to reserve an empty, invisible box of the correct proportions while the asset downloads in the background.
So the layout is locked in before the image even arrives. That makes total sense, and we apply that exact same logic to ad slots.
Right, because an ad network might serve a tiny text link or a massive interactive billboard into the exact same container. The browser has no idea what's coming.
So the solution is applying a CSS min height property to the container div that houses the ad, ensuring it reserves the space for the largest possible asset that could populate that slot.
Exactly. But layout shifts are also frequently triggered by typography, specifically custom brand fonts.
Oh, I've seen this. Why does text jump around?
When a browser encounters a custom web font, it has to download the font file. During that network request, the browser basically has a choice. It can render nothing, creating a flash of invisible text.
Which is awful for the user.
Right. Or it can render a basic system fallback font, known as a flash of unstyled text.
The issue is that the fallback font, say, Arial and the custom brand font, will have fundamentally different letter spacing, kerning, and line heights.
Exactly. When the custom font finally finishes downloading and swaps in, a paragraph that occupied three lines of text might suddenly wrap onto a fourth line.
Pushing every DOM element below it further down the page. Boom! Layout shift.
Yep. To prevent typography from destroying your CLS score, you utilize a CSS descriptor within your font face declaration called font display. Optional.
Optional. What does that tell the browser?
It dictates a very strict behavior. It gives the browser an extremely brief window, typically 100 milliseconds, to load the custom font.
And if it doesn't make the cut?
If the network request takes longer than that 100 millisecond window, the browser renders the fallback font and, crucially, refuses to swap the custom font in later when it finally arrives.
Wow, it just abandons it.
It abandons the swap. The text layout remains perfectly stable.
Okay, so we have identified the mechanisms causing all these bottlenecks, but there is a massive translation gap between a marketer or an SEO diagnosing these issues and a software engineer actually fixing them.
Oh, communication is the hardest part.
I have personally seen this end in disaster. You send a Jira ticket to the dev team that simply says, the LCP is too high, make the homepage faster.
That is a nightmare ticket for a developer.
Right. The developer compresses a random background image by 10%, marks the ticket as complete, and the site continues to fail the Core Web Vitals assessment.
Because that kind of vague handoff guarantees friction. A developer requires tight scopes and highly specific, quantifiable instructions.
So what does a successful performance brief actually look like?
It contains three non-negotiable components. First, you explicitly state the current metric utilizing field data.
So for instance, our current CRUX field LCP on the checkout page is 4.2 seconds, failing the good threshold.
Perfect. Second, you provide the exact root cause accompanied by incontrovertible evidence. You don't just complain that the page feels slow.
You attach a screenshot of the Lighthouse Network waterfall graph, clearly demonstrating that the 400 kilobyte WebP hero image is missing a fetch priority high tag, and its download is being parser blocked by two specific marketing scripts injected via Google Tag Manager.
Exactly. You're removing the guesswork entirely.
What's the third component?
Establishing quantifiable acceptance criteria. The brief must explicitly state, this ticket is not complete until the lab LCP measured in a throttled Lighthouse simulation consistently falls below 2.5 seconds.
You anchor the fix to a verifiable local metric they can test before they deploy. I love that.
It creates accountability.
Let's follow that through to its conclusion, though. Let's say the developer receives the perfect brief, rewrites the DOM structure, optimizes the assets, and deploys the fix to the live production server today.
Okay.
If I log into my Google Search Console tomorrow morning, I expect to see my SEO ranking penalty lifted.
Yeah, this is the reality check that completely shatters expectations. It loops us right back to the measurement illusion we talked about earlier. Google's ranking systems do not care about your fresh, optimized lab data.
Right. They rely entirely on the CRUX report.
Which, as we established, is a 28-day rolling average of actual user experiences.
Ah. So if the fix goes live today, that is just a single day of passing data getting diluted by 27 previous days of terrible, slow data.
Exactly. The required process involves navigating into the Core Web Vitals report within Google Search Console, locating the specific flag issue, and manually clicking Start Tracking.
And what does that do?
This action officially opens a 28-day validation window. The status transitions to started and eventually looking good. But your new code must survive contact with reality surviving real-world network latency and older devices for that entire 28-day cycle before Google officially marks the issue as passed.
28 days. It requires immense patience.
It does. It's a fundamental shift in how we approach web architecture.
So what does this all mean? We've covered a massive amount of technical ground here today. LCP rendering, the math behind CLS, INP hydration blocking, the intricacies of async versus defer, and 28-day validation windows.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. But stepping back from the DOM parsing, Core Web Vitals represent a standardized translation of human frustration. By mastering visual stability and interactivity, you aren't just checking technical boxes for an algorithm.
No, not at all.
You are directly improving how flesh and blood people interact with your brand.
And the implementation of these metrics forces a profound evolution in web development. Google is meticulously tracking how websites behave in the real world, penalizing every single layout shift and delayed tap.
The ultimate SEO strategy is no longer confined to just optimizing title tags, keyword density, or backlink profiles.
Exactly. It has evolved into digital empathy. If performance is a core ranking factor, then the foundational design of the website is indistinguishable from its SEO strategy.
That's a great way to put it.
Every creative choice, from the weight of a custom font to the placement of an ad slot, is an SEO choice.
Here is something to mull over as we wrap up this deep dive. As AI-generated overviews and zero-click search results continue to swallow up query volume, the total amount of user traffic flowing to actual websites is going to shrink.
That's the reality of the current landscape.
Right. So when a user finally does decide to click through an AI summary and visit your actual domain, that single session carries exponentially more weight than it used to.
Every visit counts.
Exactly. Are your Core Web Vitals ready for a world where every single click is a rare make-or-break moment for your brand's survival?
Because if the page shifts right as they go to click, they aren't coming back.
Never. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the technical realities of Core Web Vitals. We'll see you next time.